You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Wednesday, September 25th, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, editor-in-chief of The Contributor, Tina Dupuy. And also, later in the program, Nicole Bell from Crooks and Liars, both talking about different aspects of journalism, ladies and gentlemen. Also on the program today, our brief but wacky national nightmare is over. Ted Cruz has stopped speaking on the floor of the Senate. In what was a non-filibuster but really long speech that was largely incoherent. And not like in the 25th or 20th hour, but really from hour one. We will provide some coverage because we're fair and balanced. Also on the program today, Atlas shrugs again. And Obamacare, new data on the cost of insurance in the exchanges looks pretty positive. Obviously, there's going to be a lot to talk about with Obamacare going forward. We will play a couple of clips from Ted Cruz, just because there are some that are really just too good to play. And then we have actually found something that will function as an antidote, so that your ears, when they begin to start to bleed, we've found something that will cauterize the bleeding, I think.
Sort of an auditory palate cleanser.
That's right. But you do got to hear some of the choice nuggets from the Ted Cruz, I don't know what to call it, extended speech. A filibuster is, just to be clear, a filibuster is something you do, the technical term at least, is when you get up in the Senate or some similar legislative body and continue to talk in hopes to prevent debate from moving forward on a specific bill. You command the floor and prevent the body from voting on a motion to proceed or to take up a bill. In this instance, before Ted Cruz actually got to the floor, he knew that there was agreed upon time frame for him to talk, and then he would stop and the bill would be voted upon. So unlike what we saw with Rand Paul's filibuster, which ultimately ended and didn't prevent the bill from going forward, or Wendy Davis's in Texas, which actually did prevent the bill from being voted upon, she was able to run out the clock. Ted Cruz's was not really a filibuster. It was just an extended speech for fundraising purposes, presumably. or for, you know, look, I'm saying this to someone who did a 12-hour show. That was not a filibuster. It was not a filibuster. It was an interesting exercise, and we got some good interviews out of it. And Ted Cruz got away with, I will say this, that early on he did mention Benihanas, and it really, that has stuck in my mind. I have not been able to get the idea of going to a Benihanas out of my mind. I don't know if there was one in New York, but.
I think there's one out on Long Island.
Can I ask you, that won't happen. Homeschooled kid, what is Benihanas?
It had nothing to do with school. Benihanas,
well, just
general
cultural isolation.
In Boston, as a kid, the big night out for us in Worcester would be to go to Benihanas, and it was a Japanese restaurant. Presumably they still exist. A Japanese restaurant where they would cook the food on a skillet in front of you. And the chefs would do all these fancy things where they would flip the pepper up in the air and bang a spatula, and the shrimp would go up in the air and land on the grill, and it was...
Apparently, Sam, there is a
small portions, there's
a Benihana on 56th and 6th Avenue.
There you go.
We're there. End of story. So my compliments to Ted Cruz. This was not all in vain. I will be going to Benihana's, and maybe I will tweet out some pics. All right, we got to take a break. When we come back, Tina Dupuy. Back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program editor-in-chief of The Contributor, Tina Dupuy. Hello, Tina.
Hi, Sam. How are you?
I am doing great. Now, do we have that right? It's editor-in-chief, right? Not editor-and-chief.
Editor-and-chief, yeah.
Okay. And you guys are launching, is that right? I mean, you've been in beta, but you guys have, are you full-blown launch now?
We are full-blown launch as of this week.
All right, we got a link. It's relevant to your piece, actually, what The Contributor is. But tell us what The Contributor is.
The Contributor is a new news network. We basically have about 150 blogs, news sites that we pull from, plus a couple of original columnists and freelance writers. And we're doing this kind of, you know, little publicity stunt called Paying Writers.
Weird.
And, you know, we're kind of on the forefront of this technology, going to get a patent on it, stuff like that. We're kind of radical in our approach to these people called content providers. And with a focus on news as opposed to side boob and like whatever Miley Cyrus is doing this second.
Yeah, I'm confused. I'm at the contributor.com right now. You got a story on the top about the Trans-Pacific Partnership and fracking. And then you've got a story about the Obamacare premiums. Look good, but Medicare for All would be better. Cory Booker's tall tales catching up to his disappointing record of reform. All great stories. But here's the awkward part. When I look to the right, I see these sub-columns of civil rights and environment, international, guns in America, education, healthcare, and I don't. Where's the stuff about the celebrity? Like, what? Somebody got? Nobody's got divorced, or what? What happened?
Right, we're taking this gamble that we don't actually need our news subsidized by side boob. But there are studies that, you know, people, pollsters talk to human beings, Americans even, about what they want out of news, and by and large, the majority of them will say that they want more information and less fluff. That they're tired of the recap of what happened on Dancing with the Stars, and what they really want is actual information, and they want it in a concise fashion and in a candid fashion, and there appears to be a gap in the market. So that's what we're trying to fill.
It's interesting because I think to a certain extent, I don't know. I mean, it's very hard from my tiny, tiny sequestered bubble to get a sense of trends like this. But certainly like Al Jazeera America, for instance, seems to be sort of marketing in the same way. I mean, there at least is a sense that there is, I mean, all joking aside, a real hole in the market for news that doesn't involve, you know, don't go skinny dipping in New Jersey, Harry Potter star shoots down major rumor. America's diet report card. I've seen girls pull out their own teeth to look skinnier. I'm just going on what the...
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, a lot of the times, like when you watch Bill O'Reilly, they'll have things like, I'm disgusted by all of this sex. And then that will give them an opportunity to show women in bikinis for an entire segment, right? And I think that there is room to be, you know, not puritanical about sex and not, and be sex positive, but like there is a time and a place for that. And there's also news, and this stuff is really important. But like the kind of link baiting that we're subjected to, and the like kind of tawdry celebrity meltdowns and like flame wars between people who I don't care about. I don't care what their opinion is about anything because I don't know who they are and shouldn't care who they are. That kind of stuff. And policymakers and people with actual power are not being paid attention to, and we're not kind of watching that. We're not watching what's going on in our own communities. We're not watching. We've seen what happens when we don't watch what goes on in our own state houses. That kind of stuff goes kind of unwatched. And because we're spending all our time worrying about, you know, whatever celebrity is having, you know, a mental breakdown. So that I believe, and this is my gamble with the site, is that there really is a demand for that kind of information. And so, you know, we've been really fortunate. We've had a really good summer. We've been on the front page of Reddit a couple of times. We're getting a really good response. And so we're just going to continue with this. I know you were the first person, and we cut a check too. We use your content all the time. It's fantastic. We're really excited. The piece, the editorial that you mentioned, was, you know, just my story about, you know, I came into this world as a stand-up comic, and I failed into journalism a couple of years ago, and, you know, into a marketplace that was just a disaster, because suddenly, instead of getting a paycheck, journalists were being expected to just for exposure, do the same thing that used to actually give them money. So my counterpart 20 years ago, you know, had like apparently health benefits and a retirement plan, and, you know, this thing called money in their bank account, like every other week, I guess, was a regular thing. And, and that just kind of, that has dissipated. And when we talk about, this kind of like local war movement, and everyone wants to know who cultivated their local kale, people don't know where their news comes from. And oftentimes, if you don't pay journalists, then special interests will pay writers to do the same thing. And so we get our information from like bizarre sources. And it also, and I'm sure you've covered this, the paid internship kind of movement. If you only the well-off can afford not to work.
Right.
So you know, it kind of boils off the diversity of the newsroom. And if you don't have journalists who are making a living, or if journalism doesn't make you a living, then people won't, you know, it's only people who have money who will do it, and everyone else has to go somewhere else.
I mean, both those points are really great points. I mean, one is that we already have a problem where our mainstream media is so out of touch. I mean, even and you know, obviously, through my own myopia, I see this from you know, even from left wing commentators on the mainstream news and cable news. These are people whose perspective is so limited from a socioeconomic sense that they can't even imagine what is problematic about cutting things like Social Security, the concept of what Americans are going through on a daily basis in terms of unemployment. And in terms of paying their bills, I mean, there's such an obliviousness. And you make a great point that we hear a lot about diversity in terms of race and gender, but we hear very little conversation about diversity in the newsrooms about socioeconomic class and you're right. I mean, if journalism becomes one of two things, one, it either becomes sort of a hobby for those who can afford it. And when we talk about the national media, we're talking about having to live in a metropolitan area that is incredibly expensive. And the other being, we are seeing increasingly media being subsidized by big money that invariably has a bias towards big money. And that's one of the things that I've struggled with this show is, you know, there's been, I'm not beating people away from the door on a daily basis, but there has been opportunities that on first blush look good in terms of getting funding for this show. But it comes with, and perhaps I'm overly sensitive to it, I'm always concerned that it comes with strings that may not be so clear at the beginning, but may come in the form down the road of like, why are you doing this? Why are you harping on this aspect so much? And I just don't feel comfortable getting into that type of position. The flip side of it is that we spend, you know, more time than I want counting nickels and, you know, having to, you know, plead on a daily basis for more member support. But really, this is the way that the media is going. And so, you know, and I will say that your outlet, you know, I'm not putting braces on my daughter from what we're getting from the contributor, but it's something that says, you know, we value the work you're doing. And it brings, hopefully it brings some eyeballs to your site. How do you guys, is it a straight advertising model for you guys?
It's an advertising and sponsor model, exactly. You know, and the thing about sharing content, sharing money with our content providers is not that we're going to put your child through college. But the fact of the matter is that content has value for advertisers. It has value for the site owner. It should therefore also be valuable to the people who create it. You know, I mean, it's more of like a tip than anything else, but that is, it's a valuable commodity. And but to everyone else except for the person who actually made it. And that's been something that started with this thing called the internet, you know, and the blogging. And it is something that we've just kind of accepted as a thing, and it doesn't have to be that way. We can take a stand, and it is not okay. This thing has value, content has value, and people should be paid for what they do, especially when it's something that is quality. I mean, you add a lot to our site. Having your content there adds a lot to our site. And so, like, of course we should, you know, share the revenue that we are making off of your content. I mean, it just, you know, it's, to me, it's an ethically something that we should do. You know, and we're, like I said, we're not going to solve any problems, but like it's definitely, you know, putting, you know, our money where our mouths are.
And we've seen, I mean, Arianna Huffington knows that this content has quality. They sold the Huffington Post for hundreds of millions of dollars, based on, you know, and to their credit, the Huffington Post has got some very good reporters, and they will also generate some very important reported pieces, but largely the Huffington Post was generated its value from not paying people. I mean, it provided some form of compensation. I mean, this is sort of the dilemma, right? Is that when you're coming up, the idea of exposure is worth something to you as a writer, particularly in this sort of era when it is all about personal branding in some fashion. But at one point, the worm turns and you're at one point you need to get paid.
Right. Well, you made this point earlier. You know, when you watch, I watch a lot of cable news and, you know, and listen to the radio, and you can just tell that there is nobody who has ever struggled to feed themselves. There is nobody who has ever struggled, worked more than one job, had their bills turned pink, been evicted, you know, had their like car breakdown and just like had to leave it wherever it was because they had like that kind of broke, have never had that kind of adversity in their lives because they're very flippant about these kind of abstract numbers about our, you know, people in this country. You know, when they talk about food stamps, it's like, well, if we cut off food stamps, they're just going to have to get a job. And it's like, okay, that's clearly you've never been hungry. And that's something that comes from somebody of privilege. They've never, ever struggled. And, you know, and it's quite obvious when you, in our media culture today, that a lot of the people are the media elite. They are, you know, what we refer to at Crooks and Liars. I know you're having Nicole Bell on after me, as the villagers. You know, they're like, they've been all to the same schools. They all know each other. They kind of all have this kind of same think. They all have the same values. And they really have never, by and large, most of them have never struggled economically.
And I think
kind of have this, like, they're out of touch, completely tone deaf to this kind of economic, these economic issues.
And I think almost even, and as equally distressing, if not more so, is that they're, experience of for the most part, I have not had to deal with those type of issues in my life. I mean, there's been times where I've been out of work and I've never had that level of drama. And I think to a certain extent, just my interactions via email or by the phone with my audience, I think, has, at the very least, makes me aware of what people are going through. And that is, I think, the thing that is really genuinely missing from these people. They, you know, short of occasionally being, you know, taking a rickshaw or talking to their cab driver or to their driver, the exposure that these people have is incredibly limited. I mean, that's been my experience in conversations with people in a green room, from people who you would imagine know better or should know better, is that they are just fundamentally out of touch. I mean, you know, that I don't know that you need to have experienced these things necessarily firsthand, but it's good to know people who have, and good to be aware that this is ongoing. Before you sit down and begin to espouse an opinion about how easily these things are overcome. And I think that's really what occurs to me is really genuinely problematic.
No, I totally agree that you can absolutely be empathetic towards somebody else's economic circumstances and you don't have to have personally gone through it. But I think that when you have a colleague who grew up on food stamps and kind of pulled them up themselves up by their bootstraps, instead of just a bunch of other people who are like you because they were well off and then therefore able to get an internship and therefore able to get the job in the newsroom where you are, I think. And so then there's nobody to kind of challenge those beliefs to say like, hey, that's actually not how that works. That's what I think is more important, and that's something that we just don't focus on. When we have a certain class of people reporting, telling the stories really,
yep,
of America, when there's a lot more to that. I mean, there are 46 million Americans who are living in poverty. There are 35 million Canadians in this world. We have 46 million Americans living in poverty. Why don't we hear those stories? Why aren't we like sick of hearing those stories? And we're not. We're too busy, How is it pronounced? Nicki Minaj? Or whatever. There's so many. That should be horribly embarrassing to us as a nation. And it's like this kind of buried lead of how we let our citizenry live, and then, to have Congress kind of brazenly cut food stamps, vote to cut food stamps in a time when people are truly struggling, it's gobsmacking. But
This is a problem this is a problem that is only going to grow. I mean, in terms of this lack of economic diversity in the newsroom is bound to grow. I mean, you've got $1 trillion worth of student debt out there. You're going to college. The rationality of, or I should say, the decision that you've got to make is to exit college with a tremendous amount of loans to go into a profession that is basically paying you with exposure. And if you hit the lottery, then maybe it will pay off. But if you don't, if you're just reporting, you're not going to build your brand sufficiently, you've made a dire mistake. I mean, I think I saw Sarah Jaffe tweeting just the other day that, she's got invoices that are extant over 90 days from media outlets, and, she can't pay her bills. At one point, people are going to start saying, I am driven to enter this profession, but I just cannot do it. And that's presuming, of course, they even have that that option is even on the table. They may have to be taken care of a sick one, or they may have a family. I mean, et cetera, et cetera. It's a real big problem. Do you see? I mean, what is the answer here, or is there an answer?
The answer is that journalism has to pay. that's the only solution that I can come up with. That if this is a profession that traditionally has paid the bills, we are not all George Will. We do not all make, north of six figures, but it traditionally is something that has paid the bills. Interns need to be paid. Content providers need to be paid. And then it is something that is less risky. So people who come from different socioeconomic parts of the country, experiences can become journalists, can become storytellers, and be able to make a living doing that. Otherwise, it's way too risky. If you have student loans, if you have anything, you're going to have to go to something that has, you know, more stability. And right now we just don't have that. I think we need to start the conversation, and that's what I'm trying to do now. Because we just, I mean, and I had a hard time getting this editorial that you mentioned. It's on thecontributor.com if you guys want to go see it. I had a really hard time getting it published because,
you do a column that gets distributed in 200
right, I like 90 newspapers, right? But and the LA Times actually wrote me back and said, look, it's too navel-gazing. They didn't want it, like they didn't want to even talk about this kind of issue.
What they really meant is our navel's very ugly.
But exactly, like it was like really something that's horribly embarrassing to journalists, and they don't actually want to talk about it. I mean, and I didn't realize like how visceral that was. But the truth of the matter is, this is a profession that's gone through some real tough times. I talk about it in the piece. You know, in 2007, we lost 15,000 newspaper jobs. In 2008, it was another 16,000. You know, that's 30,000 in 2 years. That was like, no, you know, that's a buried lead. It was just a bloodletting. And all those journalists who lost their jobs, they went into a profession where suddenly there was no money. It was just for exposure, you know. So what they basically had been doing their entire lives as a job became a hobby. All of a sudden. So, you know, it's been going through some very weird transitions, and we can get into the weeds of media ownership and all of that. But the bottom line is, if we want quality journalism, it has to start with paying journalists a living wage. Labor doesn't see journalists as you know, labor, but it absolutely is. And it's, you know, if we want our stories to be told, if we want to be informed, we have to have the people who are responsible for that information. We have to make sure that they are able to pay their light bill.
Tina Dupuy,
Tina
Dupuy, editor-in-chief of The Contributor. Go to thecontributor.com. It is thecontributor.com. Of course, we will have a link on the homepage of majority.fm. TheContributor.com. It's great stuff. It is one of my daily, as I cycle through sites, it's one of my daily go-tos. I really appreciate you coming on, Tina.
You're great stuff, Sam. Thank you.
Talk to you soon. All right, folks, bye. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll be talking to Nicole Bell from Crooks and Liars. Talking about journalism, apparently Chuck Todd has an interesting idea of what his job is. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. Nicole Bell, senior editor of crooksandliars.com. Welcome to the program, Nicole.
Thank you so much, Sam.
So, Nicole, I think I first got wind of this when I saw your petition that you began to circulate. It has since really gotten a tremendous amount of support. But tell us what is the petition about?
Well, last Thursday, Chuck Todd was on Morning Joe on MSNBC talking about Obamacare, or the Affordable Care Act, as us liberals like to call it, and was on with Ed Rendell, and they were talking about how, you know, the Obamacare is essentially very unpopular. And Ed Rendell pointed out that the reason why it's so unpopular is because there's so much misinformation out there. And Chuck Todd said, well, yeah, the Republicans are selling their message really well. And then he kind of went on and said, but, you know, I hear this a lot, and I don't think it's my job to sell Obamacare. That's the president's job. And I heard that, and it just, you know, makes me grind my teeth, because at Crooks and Liars, for the last 9 years, we've been listening to journalists basically abdicate their job of fact-checking, just the most basic fact-checking, and allowing every single issue to become this, excuse me, he said, she said, of, well, Democrats say this and Republicans say that, and we'll leave it at that, without ever giving people information, without ever giving people the facts so that they have nothing to base it on, nothing to know. And if you look at the polls on Obamacare, 80% of Americans don't know what it does or how it impacts them. I mean, that's a huge abdication of the responsibility to fact check. When, you know, Chuck Todd comes on TV and says, yeah, the Republicans' messaging is really, you know, is really strong, that's not telling people that what the Republicans are doing is lying about Obamacare and scaring the American people.
Well, what's also really stunning about that is that, you know, if we weren't talking about a law that was already begun to have been implemented, that we are at this point not talking about a political campaign, we're not even talking about lobbying to pass a law. We're talking about something that exists. I mean, you could do the same thing. You could say the same thing about Medicare. I mean, you know, I mean, if Chuck Todd, if the Republicans were out there saying that Medicare is not controlled by the government is coming to take away your Medicare, the idea that Chuck Todd would not feel obligated to say, actually, that's not true. Medicare is a government program, is fantastical. I mean, the reality here is that this has already been litigated. This is what we never hear are also the stories of what if we were to repeal Obamacare at this point? It would be disastrous for the entire medical industry at this point, because this is something that has been in the works for a couple of years. It is moving forward. That's what's even more weird about it to me, is that this isn't even a question about an agenda to get to a political place. There's a reality here, and that is that Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, whatever you want to call it, exists.
Right, right. And the if you talk to American people and you ask them about the parts of Obamacare that have already been implemented, such as, you know, allowing your children to stay on your policy until they're 26, about not being dropped for pre-existing conditions, about not being dropped once you hit your cap, these are things that are exceptionally popular with the American people. They love that. So you go boom, 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 boom. Do you want this? And Americans say yes. You say, do you want Obamacare? And immediately Americans say no. And that's because they keep hearing from Republicans that this is a failed program. They keep hearing from Republicans that this is going to destroy the country. You know, Ted Cruz, in between reading Green Eggs and Ham, said the most threatening thing to the American people right now is Obamacare. And I for the life of me can't figure out how that is. You know, and it's one thing to say that on the Senate floor, but if he comes on the Sunday shows and he says that, then I feel strongly that, you know, Chuck Todd or David Gregory or George Stephanopoulos, whoever he's talking to, has an obligation to their viewership to call them on that and say, but wait a second. You know, this is the truth, isn't it?
Now, didn't Chuck Todd...
And they never do.
Didn't Chuck Todd reply to sort of the critique of his comments on Twitter? What did he say?
He got a little testy, and he said, of course, you know, I didn't say that we shouldn't call out lies. But, you know, it's one thing to backtrack on Twitter. It's another thing to actually do it in action. And right. and we don't see that in action. And we don't see any of our journalists. And you know, Chuck Todd is sort of, I hate saying this, he's sort of a useful tool in this because he's not the only person who's doing this, but he's certainly not even the most egregious person doing it, but he's the only one who actually openly admitted that he doesn't feel like it's his job to do it. But, you know, we've never heard Chuck Todd come up to, you know, Rand Paul and say, but, you know, if you are successful in repealing Obamacare, what does that do to the parents who have a child who can't get insurance because they can't find a job? What does that do to the parents whose child has, you know, leukemia and has been dropped by their insurance company? These are things that are being protected for the American people by Obamacare. What do you think will happen? And putting it in those real-world terms, these real-world aspects, instead of this kind of ethereal, oh, this is the worst thing that ever happened to the country.
You know, it's interesting because he blames the administration for not selling Obamacare enough. And I think that there is certainly, I think that critique may be the case, but that does not inoculate him from his responsibility of still saying, hey, you know what? The Obama administration hasn't been very good at reminding people that it's daylight at 12 noon. But the reality is it's daylight at 12 noon.
Right.
I mean,
right. The whole notion that he has to sell the program is a big straw man. Nobody's asking journalists to sell programs. What we're asking them to do is present facts so that their viewers are informed. And all you have to do is look at polls to know that most Americans are hugely uninformed about what Obamacare is or and does.
So you started a petition and a couple other organizations got behind it. Tell us how many people have signed this already.
The last time I checked, it was just under 140,000. So that's great. I mean, 140,000. Right. And we went out. I've been working with Credo. We went out with a letter yesterday asking for people to actually call NBC News and tell them, you know, we expect journalists to be journalists and we expect them to present facts and to call out lies. And, you know, my initial letter said, you know, call out Republican lies. But honestly, I want them to call out all lies. If a Democrat is lying, call that out, too. You know, but when you come out to call out the lies of politicians, nine times out of ten, it's a Republican that it's going to be. But, you know, we went out with a letter yesterday saying, call NBC. NBC was getting like 100 calls an hour.
Wow.
The last time I checked, we've had about 1,500 calls reported to NBC News. So I'm just thrilled that, you know, this has resonated and that people agree with me that journalists, the media has really fallen down on the job. And, you know, we've got two wars in the Middle East that sort of show that, you know, the media hasn't been doing the hard work of being adversarial towards the government, because that's really what their function is. That's why they're called the Fourth Estate.
And you know, the argument that back in the day that, you know, the anti-war or the, you know, leave the weapons inspectors crowd in has really not done their job in selling this would have been laughable. So what have you heard what the reaction is in NBC News? I mean, do you have any sense? Do you have any? Have you heard from anybody working inside there? Have you seen any indication that this is impacting them in some way?
Well, it's been really interesting, Sam, because I've had a really good relationship with people at MSNBC because of Crooks and Liars for years. And I do hear from people at MSNBC for various shows, you know, on a regular basis. And I've had absolute radio silence, which is very unusual. So I'm pretty sure they've been told not to talk to me anymore. But it's also interesting because when you watch the shows, a lot of the hosts are sort of circling their wagons around Chuck Todd, and you hear a lot of, well, President Obama hasn't really sold this program. You know, I've been hearing that repeated over and over and over again on all the different shows on MSNBC, and, you know, That may or may not be true, but that's sort of beside the point.
Well, you know, when he sold it is when it passed.
Right. I mean, clearly, you know, it worked.
That's the thing, is that at this point, it's really, you know, the idea of you never hear, you'd never hear this construct with anything else, which is just very interesting. And part of it is, you know, it's a relatively rare phenomenon that you see the attempts to repeal a policy before it's been instituted in such a public way. I mean, generally, it's just like we want to roll back financial regulations in Dodd-Frank. It's just an interesting construct, and it's you know, I can only imagine what the dynamics are over there in terms of like, you know, how much the people can sort of say like, yeah, this is actually a problem. We need to do a better job of calling out the sort of fibs. I mean, I will say this, that the one or two places I've seen that do a very good job with this is, you know, places like, you know, Wonkblog, which is, you know, theoretically not as partisan or ideological as MSNBC is, but they're doing a better job of just simply doing the fact checking, because presumably they're just reporting more on the actual realities of the policy versus the, you know, what is going to generate, I guess, you know, some political heat, I guess. I don't know.
Right. Well, I think there's a very cushy relationship between on-air talent and, you know, politicians in Washington. And, you know, there's a lot of marriages in between them. There's, you know, a lot of cocktail parties. There's a lot of dinners. There's a lot of benefits. And, you know, there is something inherently corrupting about that, that it's hard to be mean to someone that you're going to go and have a barbecue with, you know, the following Saturday. And John McCain in particular figured that out a long time ago, right, and has been courting the press ever since. And, you know, they make a big point of showing John McCain's barbecue, you know, his big weekend barbecue in Arizona where he invites everybody from the media, and it's a big deal. You know, and that is one of the problems, is that the media has become too embedded in politicians to be able to actually accurately and factually report on them.
I remember reading Alexei Sayles back in the book about the old comedy days in Britain, I guess in the late 80s, maybe it was. Alexei Sayles said, you know, the problem with success for comedians is you get famous, you get to be, you end up being friends with Phil Collins, and you can't talk about how much his music sucks. And
exactly.
It's a similar dynamic. Well, Nicole, we've put a link to the petition on our blog at majority.fm. Really appreciate your coming on and talking to us about us. And congratulations. That's a tremendous, I mean, frankly, off the top of my head, I'm willing to bet that 140,000 signatures represents a significant portion of the number of people who watch Chuck Todd's show on a daily basis.
I think you're actually correct. Yes.
So congratulations to you on that. I appreciate you coming on and talking to us about it.
Thank you so much for asking me, Sam.
Nicole Bell, folks, crooksandliars.com. Now, folks, we have reached that time where we get ahead into the better half of the show, where we will play some highlights of Ted Cruz's non-filibuster. I mean, I realize this is maybe arguably the functional equivalent of showing pictures of the Hilton sisters or whatever it is on our blog, but it's a lot less what?
A lot less pretty in every possible way.
Yeah, I mean,
it's just really.
Although the creep factor, I think, is there with both of those.
Yeah,
but and we also have a very special auditory palate cleanser. Is that the right
word?
I
would say an auditory palate cleanser.
All right. So, so that
also in the better half, our pop culture references are more relevant than the Hilton sisters.
Sorry, buddy. You know, I don't know. All right, we got to take a break. We'll be right back. Folks, do not forget that the app is available. You go to majorityapp.com, and you can get the app it has been rock solid as far as I can tell on iOS. We've got some tweaks to make for iOS 7. That will come in our first update. Some Android devices give us a problem. It's just a function of the many different hardware idiosyncrasies of Android. There's not a lot we can do about it, but we're working on some potential fixes going forward. You can support this program by hitting the donate button on your app. It's in the support show tab. You can donate on the homepage of majority.fm. You can click on our Amazon link and buy your Amazon crap through our link. We get a kickback. Or the best of all is to become a member. You know, one of the things I mentioned to Tina was that over the years, we have made a point of telling people that if you cannot financially afford a membership but want to have access to the better half of the program, we will always, always work out a deal with you. We will turn no one away for financial reasons. And it has been, and frankly, you know, I've heard from a lot of members over the years who have had just unbelievably bad luck when it comes to health issues, when it comes to work issues. And it's very sad to read these things. It's and it also, you know, is a it's a good reminder for me of what just people are going through out there on a daily basis. And sometimes we share those with people, but more often than not, we don't. It's not, you know, meant for publication. But it's something to keep in mind. So if you are one of those who are fortunate enough not to have those financial problems, but you enjoy the show on a daily basis, please become a member today at majority.fm. All right, folks, also don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate to get a 10% discount using the coupon code MAJORITY. See you on the flip side.